Hello again, and as you could tell from the way the part one of this series ended, right in mid-sentence, I am not free of all my passions. I'm very passionate about you guys and teaching. And I suppose after 30 years, I will continue to meditate on seeing through my passions and just being a calm, facilitator for your enlightenment, your information. But as of yet, the Buddhist teachings are so immensely profound and immediately understandable that I'm convinced this is the time for the propagation of this ultimate teaching, the goal of Shakyamuni Buddha and his teachings from the start. And my commitment is to end the confusion, push away the stuff that's obsolete and no longer valid, and just give you the straight story because it makes so much sense. Anyway, I'm spending a lot of time on the Diamond Sutra. This is part two. I'm not going to go all the way to the end because there's just too much in this for me to do all in one sitting. We're already on part two after all. But I think so far after part one, you've got a pretty good gist. So let me continue and really nail this down. I think there's some really good, got about four more sections I've identified here that I'd like to share with you. Again, this is the Diamond Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the perfection of wisdom sutra. It's a lot of names for it. The Heart Sutra is in here too, but it's mainly considered, well, it's the perfection of wisdom sutra. It includes all of that. Whether you read the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines or Kanzi's full edition of the long version. I'm enjoying this book right now because they've taken the time to take apart each stanza and lend a lot of written commentary from India, China, scholars who reinterpret in their own words. Again, the goal being, as Shakyamuni exhorted all his followers, do not get stuck on the words, but instead meditate, concentrate, and understand or attempt to understand the meaning behind the words. Don't get stuck on the words. And by reading these other commentaries with completely different grammar, sentence structures, words of reference, different times, you can hear all of their rhetoric trying to describe the same point. And I find it very helpful because that helps me focus even more tightly on the meaning, rather than feeling like I'm applying my own meaning to just one reading of it, although sometimes that's very enlightening. Having the benefit of other scholars, Buddhist scholars, reinterpreting in their own words is really, really helpful, can help you get there faster. So I highly recommend this book, okay? So I'm going to go on now. Here's another quote from the sutra. Moreover, Subhuti Bodhisattvas should practice charity in this manner for the benefit of all beings. And how so? Subhuti, the perception of a being is no perception. Likewise, all the beings of whom the Tathagata speaks are thus no beings. And how so? Subhuti, what the Tathagata says is real. what the Tathagata says is true and is as he says it is, and is not other than as he says it is. What the Tathagata says is not false. Again, Tathagata, Buddha, Bhagavan, whatever his title, his title, his idea is not a his. It's our mind, our collective mind. Okay, our personal mind as well as our collective mind. But you won't understand collective mind until you get past your attachment to perceptions of self and other. Do you see? You can think my mind, my mind, my mind. That's a tongue twister. But eventually, when you become less attached to the idea in your mind of a you, a specificness of you or self or I and other, then that mind obviously is all the mind. You see? All right. Asanga, Indian scholar, says, such things as names and bodies aren't fit thoughts for saints. The Buddhas have no such thoughts, because they see things truly. Again, this is the mind. Vasubandhu comments, beings are simply names. Remember the world of name and form? The form is mind, but we obsess about individuation. So we have to put labels. Vasubandhu again says, beings are simply names. They are a combination of the five aggregates, karma, and lack any essence of their own. Because neither a self nor a dharma has any nature of its own, Buddhas get rid of such perceptions. What are Buddhas? It's still an attachment to self and other, isn't it? There is only Buddha. Mind. Vasubandhu says, the doubt arises, if there is no way to realize the goal, how are we to view the cause of such a goal? Asanga says, the road whose goal can't be reached is still the goal's main cause. The words of Buddhas all are true, and fourfold is this knowledge. Vasubandhu comments, the Tathagata proclaims four kinds of teachings because by means of this true knowledge, he does not falsely teach Buddhahood. Buddhahood. What he says is real because he does not falsely teach the four truths of the Hinayana. What he says is true because he does not falsely teach the doctrine of selfless suchness of the Mahayana. What he says is, as he says it is, and because he does not falsely prophesy but penetrates all three time periods, what he says is not other than as he says it is. I like the word penetrate, because earlier I was trying to get a description with words of seeing past, through, around perceptions. Identify that you're perceiving in your mind, and then look through that perception. So penetrate, good word. Asanga says, their teachings of the vow, the lesser path, the greater way, their prophecies are not fallacious claims. Vasubandhu comments, from the moment Buddhas vow to seek the goal of Buddhahood, they make no false claims, whether in regard to the Hinayana, the Mahayana, or their prophecies of attainment. So here he's clarifying, Hinayana isn't worthless. It's just misunderstood to be the end-all be-all. It's simply a step. It's a black belt, ready to learn. Now that it understands the nature of self, even though it's still attached to it, the next step to fully detach, fully penetrate Buddha, fully be released, is to help others understand. By connecting with others, we unite the mind much further than by simply selfishly doing it for ourselves. The Bodhisattva path opens an infinite amount of liberation, and it is a true penetrating loss of the idea of self or no self. All of it is construct. How much more immense is that? Sheng Yi says, the merit of a bodhisattva who practices charity free of these four perceptions is like space. It extends throughout the heavens. It extends throughout the hells. It extends throughout the realm of hungry ghosts. It extends throughout mankind. It can save those who are drowning, and it can save those who are burning. Thus do bodhisattvas benefit all beings through their merit by practicing charity free of all perceptions. Hui Neng says, a bodhisattva doesn't practice charity for his own happiness, but to break through miserliness within and to benefit other beings without. But the Tathagata says that perceptions of self and other are ultimately subject to destruction and not truly real. Hence, all beings are fictitions or fictions. If one can get free of the deluded mind, there are no beings to save. But you can only come to that by attempting to do it. Huining also says, what is real, quote unquote, is that all sentient and non-sentient beings have the Buddha nature. What is true is that beings who perform evil deeds will reap a bitter reward. What is, as he says, is that beings who do good deeds will have happy fortunes. What is not false is that the Dharma of the Prajnaparamita produces the Buddhas of the past, the present, and the future. What is not other than, as he says, is that the meaning of the Dharma that is good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end is subtle, and there is no god, spirit, or teacher of any sect who can vanquish or destroy it. Now, from the sutra again. Moreover, Subhuti, in the Dharma realized, taught, and reflected on by the Tathagata, there is nothing true and nothing false. See how this is penetrating and going through and beyond perception? He's really getting into it now, isn't he? On that stanza, Shang Yi says, quote, the heart of this teaching is empty and still and the heart of this teaching is empty and still, and contains no perception to realize. Thus, it is not true. But in its empty, still heart, it contains an infinite body of pure merit. Hence, it is not false. If we said it existed, and yet we could not realize it, this would make it not true. And if we said it did not exist, and we could never exhaust it, this would make it not false. Thus, the Dharma realized by the Tathagata cannot be said to exist, nor can it be said not to exist. Because it doesn't exist as a separate thing. Vasubandhu says, the sutra says that there is nothing true or false in the Dharma realized and taught by the Tathagata. What does this mean? Asanga says, nothing is realized, and yet it still agrees. Thus, it's neither true nor false, but taught for those who cling to words. Ah, that's an interesting reflection. So now we understand these puzzles that he keeps putting in front of us in words, because there are four people who are attached to words, to break their attachment, to see beyond, to penetrate their own perceptions. See how helpful it is to have these other scholars commenting on this? Dao Chuan says, it's the salt in the water. It's the dye in the color. My song goes, it's hard as iron, it's soft as butter. It's there when you see it, it's gone when you look. It's with you every step, though no one really knows it. I'll let you read those. The poetry is interesting, but I tend to stay away from it in these dialogues of study. I don't know. Maybe it's because of my own karma. Let's move on to the next one. I'm telling you, this book is amazing. Chapter 15. In the previous chapter, the Buddha told Subhuti that practicing the paramitas of wisdom, forbearance, and charity was possible only if the practitioner was free of such delusions as a self. In this chapter, he anticipates those who might take this to mean to get rid of the self, to sacrifice the self on the altar of some deity or cause, or to throw the self into the black hole of nihilism. Are you listening, Hinayanists? Chao Ming titles this The Merit of Understanding the Sutra. Hui Nying says, the merit of understanding and reciting of benefiting oneself and others has no limit and cannot be measured. Thus follows a chapter on the merit of understanding the sutra. The sutra. Furthermore, Subhuti, if a man or woman renounce their self-existence during the morning as many times as there are grains of sand in the Ganges, and likewise renounce their self-existence midday as many times as there are grains of sand in the Ganges, and renounce their self-existence during the afternoon as many times as there are grains of sand in the Ganges. Chen Yue Sing says, the Buddha was concerned that his disciples might become attached to the perception of forbearance and uselessly give up their bodies without the slightest benefit to their own nature or the nature of others. Hence, he brings this up in chapter 13 and again here. Sheng Yi says, the physical body depends on karma for its existence and it has no nature of its own. Just as a wave depends on the wind for its existence and has no nature of its own, the sea is one while waves are countless. Billions of waves rise and fall during the morning. Billions of waves rise and fall during the midday, and billions of waves rise and fall during the afternoon. Thus, over the course of millions and trillions of kalpas, the number of illusory waves is far beyond reckoning. But all those illusions can't compare to the one reality. They can't compare to the sea, the mind. The waves are our self and other, but we're all in the mind, the sea. Noble sons and daughters are also like this, those of us who practice Buddhism. There is only the one sea of our Buddha nature. But when people are confused, the sea of Buddha nature becomes the sea of consciousness. And the sea of consciousness becomes the sea of passion. And the sea of passion becomes the sea of karma. And the sea of karma becomes the sea of suffering. And from the sea of suffering, they receive countless, limitless karmic bodies. Why does the population continue to expand in the earth? There it is. Thus, on top of confusion, they pile up confusion without end and without limit. But all those illusions can't compare to the one reality, namely, the true form of all dharmas as non-existent. I added the non-existent. I think the points are being made pretty emphatic and clear here from the sutra. And someone heard this Dharma teaching and did not reject it, the body of merit produced as a result would be immeasurably, infinitely greater. How much more so if they not only wrote it down, but grasped it, memorized it, and recited it, mastered it, and explained it in detail to others. Key. Oral transmission of the Buddha's teaching seems to have remained the preferred form of instruction among monastic communities until transmission among the laity became increasingly important in the centuries immediately before and after the beginning of the Christian era. Also, while some commentators suggest that writing is placed first here because it produces less merit than reciting or explaining this sutra, others say it is placed first to emphasize its importance in the spread of Buddhism beyond monastic walls. Seng Chao says, giving has limits, belief has none. How much more so if people uphold and transmit what they believe? Emperor Wu of the Liang dynasty asked Bodhidharma, I have built so many monasteries and copied so many sutras and supported so many monks. How great would you say is my merit? Bodhidharma replied, no merit. Isn't that a kick in the head? You supported many. You've done a lot of great deeds. But you haven't shared this with anyone else. This is a big point in this sutra too, when you read the whole thing, is the materialistic nature of self and other that the arhat hasn't let go of yet. You can only let go of that materialism once you have true compassion for others, which ironically results in the negation of the idea of other. That's why it's so important. Until you really, have you ever noticed just in daily life that, like when you're in school, it happens a lot, or your work environment, you see people and for some reason you make a decision about them, you don't even know them, that there's someone you don't want to care to know or that you don't like. You don't really have a foundation for it. Maybe you've heard rumors. Maybe you just decided. And someday, time goes by. Someday you get put in a situation where you have to communicate with that person. You don't even do it on your own. It's just a committee gets named. Blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden you get exposed to that person as they actually are. And your mind sort of sees that, and your brain, your human mind, your mind has to change. And it kind of stuns you, and it kind of has doubts. But over time, you start, man, I like that person. And then you have to ask yourself, why didn't I like them? What was the problem? So that's a very simplistic example, but that's a huge shift, isn't it? If all you're thinking about is yourself and your liberation, and then you start getting involved with other people, not just to know them, but to facilitate them coming to these teachings and these realizations as you have. You don't have to have complete realization to do that. The very act of stumbling through your humanity to get them to see something and the responsibility of that is a bodhisattva act. So you're on the way immediately. You've made a huge shift. And you may experience all kinds of turmoil just trying to get through to doing that. A lot of people fear, oh, if I say it, I'll look stupid or they won't understand and I don't know how to explain it. Just do it. When you first jumped into a pool of water to swim, you weren't an Olympic time trialist. It took time for you to get good at swimming, right? Xing Yi says, before a noble son or daughter hears the novels, the sutra about prajna, they don't understand at all that dharmas are empty. They view the five skandhas as their body, as their real life. But when they give away their body and life, the perception of a self that gives and the perception of a five skandha life that is given remain. As long as the mind has a subject and an object, it is a deluded mind. Hui Nang says, if people can hear the sutra and realize its truth, both self and others suddenly vanish, and they at once become Buddhas. Renouncing the body has limited merit and cannot compare with the unlimited wisdom of upholding this sutra. This makes my heart go out for those poor monks in Myanmar. They're in a compound, a monastery. They're only learning Hinayana teachings. And so they go out in public and set their bodies on fire to demonstrate how unattached they are. And yet the very act of doing that substantiates a very, very deep attachment to the body, the life, the soul. They're all self and other. Look what I can do. Look what you cannot do. It's so tragic. And it makes me want to cry. Te Ching says, the Buddha's meaning is that will, while prajna contains no words, words are prajna. They are what Shakyamuni would say in the Lotus Sutra, his ultimate teachings. A skillful means, a deployment of what is accessible to others in order to lead them to the real meaning. This is why he cautions about getting stuck on words, and yet words are wisdom because they are the initial communicator to create curiosity and ability in others. There are vice that we use as a tool, not because we want to deceive, but because we want to use skillful means to enlighten or facilitate the curiosity and enlightenment of others. They're a tool, but they're not an answer. They are wisdom. They can be wisdom. This sutra spoken by the Buddha is prajna in its entirety. If someone can believe and accept it, they will become one of the wisdom of Buddhas, one with the wisdom of Buddha. And the Buddha, by means of his own wisdom, understood that the merit of such a person was limitless. This is the merit of becoming one with the Buddha mind in the space of a single thought. We talked about single thoughts in my video. I talked about the 3,000 realms in a single moment of thought. Okay, last one, and then I'm going to close out part two, and I'll come back with a part three at some point. I got a lot of chanting to do. And hopefully my goal in doing this for myself is, of course, to help and assist all of you listening. But I want to... I started with some other smaller sutras. This is a very involved one. And at some point when I feel confident enough, I'm going to reread for I don't know how many times the Lotus Sutra. And I want to be very clear about the significance of that sutra. So, but I thought as an introduction to Mahayana, this pivotal text was very good to introduce and to understand, so that when I do get around to the Lotus things just fall into place. I've already talked about the Lankavatara, the Vimalakirti, and loosely about others, but I'm wanting to do more of a study form like this about the lotus. And before I read this last part, I wanted to remind you to please comment on this, because you'll help me tremendously, and whatever answers I can provide you on the same comment line, others who watch this will have answers to questions that I'm sure you'll raise with your own. So so thank you in advance for participating. All right. So another short quote from the sutra. For all such beings as these, Subhuti, likewise wear enlightenment upon their shoulders. There it is again. Where is enlightenment? In the mind. How do we perceive the mind? Above the shoulders. The word skanda, as in the compound punya skanda, body of merit, refers to the body from the shoulders down. Thus, by means of their inconceivable, incomparable, immeasurable, boundless bodies of merit, bodhisattvas join the lineage of Buddhas and wear the same robe of enlightenment on their shoulders. While those whose bodies of merit remain in the realms of desire or form do not. Similar wording appears in the Lotus Sutra, where the where the Buddha addresses Vaishagya Raga, the medicine king, quote, if someone should read or recite the Lotus Sutra, you should know that such a person is adorned by what adorns the Buddha. You should know that what they wear is what the Tathagata wears upon his shoulders, wears the mind. And wherever they go, they should be so honored. As for this Bodhi, enlightenment, the shoulder, Bodhidharma says, Buddhas of the past and future only talk about this mind. The mind is the Buddha, and the Buddha is the mind. Beyond the mind, there is no Buddha, and beyond the Buddha, there is no mind. This is from the Zen teachings of Bodhidharma. Yin Shun says, the question isn't simply, is one willing to undertake this, but is one able to undertake this? Those who set forth on the foremost of paths must believe this most profound of teachings and undertake such a journey out of selfless compassion and complete it by helping others without limit. Xi Ling Yun says, to shoulder means to accept the task of going about spreading this among others so that it persists for 1,000 years. Now, I think by this point in the sutra, it is abundantly clear that we've gone from arhat, hinayana, highest achievement, traversed all of that, and now we're completely within the bodhisattva training and teachings. I think it's a pretty obvious arc. Okay, read this next. The following passage in the sutra says, and how so, Subhuti, this Dharma teaching cannot be heard by beings of lesser aspiration, not by those who mistakenly perceive a self, nor by those who mistakenly perceive a being, a life, or a soul. He's going right back and forth. He's going, do you get it now? Do you get that being an arhat is not there? It's not even close to the merit of the ultimate teachings of the Bodhisattva way. You need to get unstuck. We know Subhuti got an aha about this earlier when he broke down and wept. He couldn't believe what he believed for so long, and his achievement being simply to get him on the path, not the end of the path. It's very powerful, this sutra, and very critical to understanding. For beings who lack the bodhisattva's aspiration cannot hear, grasp, memorize, recite, or master this dharma teaching. It means if you're not even, if you don't even see bodhisattva practice as the goal, you won't get it. The previous teachings won't get you there. They'll stifle you. There I go, getting passionate again. Moreover, Subhuti, wherever the sutra is explained, that place shall be honored. Whether in the realm of devas, humans, or asuras, that place shall be honored by, with prostrations and circumambulation. That place will be like a stupa. Again, the meaning of this section appears in somewhat clearer form in the Lotus Sutra, where the Buddha says, King of healing, wherever this teaching is spoken or recited or written down, wherever this sutra is found, let there be a stupa built made of the seven jewels. Let it be high and wide and exquisitely decorated. But there will be no need to place any relics inside. And why not? Because within it shall reside the Tathagata's entire body. Asanga says, those who uphold this teaching sanctify the place it's found, break through all obstructions, reach all knowledge quickly. Vasubandhu comments, those who uphold this teaching wear enlightenment upon their shoulders, hence whenever they are, that place, wherever they are, that place is honored with incense and flowers. Singh Chow says, a place isn't conscious. The reason it is venerated is because the teaching is there. The way rests in people. Tseng Feng Yi says, wherever means a city or village or farmstead or estate, a monastery or any other place. This sutra refers to the words, whether they are etched on jade or written on paper, on a whitewashed wall, or on a cliff face, or on a YouTube channel. Wherever the sutra is found, there is a Buddha. Thus, it should be venerated by the devas, humans, and asuras of every world. And I'm going to end on that. The next chapter is chapter 16. I want to really thank you, as I didn't have the chance to in part one because I got cut off. I really, really, really appreciate your watching my videos. I hope that there are kernels of maybe wisdom, but more so that they are encouraging words, encouraging in whatever fashion to motivate you to seek further, study, find out for yourself. I want to quote Shakyamuni again here. Don't follow me. Don't make images of me. I'm talking about Buddha's words here. But still, the same sense is, what I'm trying to convey to you is what's important. And if there are any sparks going off in your mind, like, what did he mean by that? Wait a minute, that was interesting. Anything like that, please pursue it. Don't let it go. It's so important for your happiness. We got to save this world, but the only reason we got to save this world, I mean, it'll go on without us, is to save one another. Let's join our minds. Let's be equanimous. Let's appreciate this precious opportunity we have living as humans. Because we can perceive. We want to learn how not to, not perceive, but how to see beyond perception so that our perceptions don't control us. That's vastly different. Thank you so much. Daimaku Sancho. Namu myo ho renge kyo, namu myo ho renge kyo, namu myo ho renge kyo. Have a wonderful time in whatever day you're in. Thank you. And we'll see each other next time.